I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
The future of farms is the future of food. No Farms, No Future is a new podcast from American Farmland Trust and Heritage Radio Network. Listen today.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, and we are going to look deep, deep, deep into the heart of the meatpacking industry with my buddy Mike Calicrate, who's been on the show a number of times over the past 12 years that I've been doing this, folks. 12 years coming up in March, just want you to know that. Mike Calicrate, in case you haven't heard one of his broadcasts before, he is the founder of Ranch Foods Direct. And he is also an independent cattle producer, a business entrepreneur, and most importantly, perhaps a political activist. He serves as an outspoken leader in addressing the rural, social, and cultural impacts of current economic trends. Think consolidation in the meat industry. He was a founding member of several farm advocacy groups, including the Organization for Competitive Markets, who have a very nifty newsletter I highly recommend, RCAF, that's R-CALF USA, which is another advocacy organization, and the Kansas Cattlemen's Association. He also was a lead plaintiff in a class action lawsuit against the world's largest meat packer at that time, IBP, now part of Tyson Foods, alleging unfair and discriminatory marketing practices. And that goes way back in the time machine to what was that? 1998, Mike?
1996.
So you have been fighting the good fight now for almost 30 years, which, you know, the fact that you're still alive, kicking, and still give a shit.
My
is a testimony to what a cussed dude you is. I mean,
well,
really.
It's a good thing nobody told me it was going to take 30 years.
Yeah, right? that would have been a deal breaker.
I'd have bought a hot dog stand.
Exactly. Yeah, you wouldn't have been doing this. Now, so you recently sent this to me, and I really loved it. And it also made me read a preceding publication on your blog. I guess that's what you call your blog, right?
Yeah, it's a blog.
The No Bull newsletter, basically.
It's where I get it out of my head and
onto paper. You're really excellent at doing that too. Yeah. So there was one that you sent me in particular, which was basically a prescription for fixing the meat industry, which finally people are, you know, the news media is recognizing that this is a monopoly that has a stranglehold on, you know, basically all of the agricultural sector, not just meat, beef, poultry, and pork, but dairy and seeds and equipment and everything. But for our purposes, we're going to talk about the meat industry. So give us the basis. What's the breakdown here? How do you fix this industry? What's your prescription? Dr. Calicrate.
Well, what kind of inspired me to write that piece over the weekend, I published it yesterday morning. It's on my blog at MikeCalicrate.com, and it's the top post. But it basically says, okay, here's how we fix it. You know, when the markets are gone and the game of monopoly is over. And that is exactly where we are today. The game of monopoly is over. You know, four big companies have all the money, have all the power. They're collecting the rents. They're extracting the wealth, and if we're going to have a, you know, an open and free society and get back to any kind of a reasonable level of competitive capitalism, we got to break up this dang monopoly. And so what I did was I just sort of went step by step, and I think back to the 1921 period, the last time we broke up the big market power of the at that time. Five big meat packers controlled about 50% of the market. Today, four meat packers control 85% of the market. So far worse today than it was then. But back then, they decided that they were going to regulate these guys. They were going to have to sell off everything except slaughter. So they were vertically integrated. I mean, they could go from the auction stockyards all the way through to the retail. I mean, they own the transportation, they own the refrigeration, they own the slaughter, and they were really pillaging and plundering. America's livestock producers, but also taking a lot of advantage of consumers. And right. So it didn't matter who you represented, whether you were caring about, you know, like a farm state legislature that would care about ranchers or farmers. We also had the consumers being highly affected. Now, what does that remind you of?
Well,
that is today. That is today.
Yeah. I mean, JBS just settled, what, $52 billion or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, $52
million. $52 million, which is a drop in their bucket, but still.
That is nothing. That is nothing. And of course, that's one of the big problems we have.
That was for price fixing.
Right. And we're settling these cases instead of prosecuting them. But,
right.
You know, we can talk about that. But here's the steps. First of all, let's regulate these big meat packers. Let's say, look, folks, you're not going to buy and sell cattle and trade for all the money you can get out of the transaction. You know, I understand the big retailers have been pushing you around for a long time. And when COVID came, you got some power over the retailers, which you most certainly exerted with higher box beef prices and lower livestock prices to producers. So Mr. Big Four Packers, you will be limited now. You will regulate you and limit you to only the drop credit value. So it's going to be in their best interest to get all they can for hides, all they can for tongues, tails, you know, hearts, livers, intestines, everything they can possibly get out of that cow. They can live on that drop credit. In fact, they can have a very nice return on their equity and their investment and to shareholders and executives by only earning what they can on the drop credit.
So that's what you mean by that. That's just the byproducts, basically.
Yeah, this is the stuff that doesn't go in a box and gets shipped out to the big retailers and food service companies. And if you go back to, you know, 1970, and if you read the article on the blog, all of the links are in there so you can fully understand what I'm talking about. But it used to be that even 22 years ago, when I started killing cattle and selling meat instead of selling fat cattle, I actually got paid for the cattle that I delivered to GNC Packing Company in Colorado Springs. And so I would drop off a load of 40 finished cattle to GNC in Colorado Springs, and they would write me a check. So I got back my carcasses, plus I got a check, because the drop credit values, the hide, head, you know, tongue, tail, all of that stuff, was worth more than the kill fee at GNC Packing Company.
Wow, amazing.
And so the history in the meat packing industry is they make money if all they get is the drop credit, they make good money.
Yeah.
But now what they're doing is they're trading the beef. They're controlling that whole supply chain to where they're marking up the meat. And you know, so we continue to lose and more at the farm and ranch gate. So make them live on the drop credit, period. They have no choice. That's it. We know what you're paying for the cattle. We know what the drop credit is, and we know what you're selling the beef for through distribution. Okay.
Right.
Now let's go back. And I love 1970. I want to use 1970 as that base that we can get back to put us back where we should be with competition and with the producer receiving his fair share of the consumer beef dollar.
Right.
So in 1970, if you look at the numbers, the producer got 65% of the consumer beef dollar. And this is exactly the same calculation and the same state of process as we have today with box beef. And so it's 65% got back to the farm and ranch gate. Today it's closer to 35%. So we've lost around 30% of our share of the consumer dollar. And this really does explain why rural America has become this seriously impoverished place.
Yes.
And on the metrics, rural America is lower on the metrics than the poorest of the urban centers around the country, as far as poverty and hunger and those metrics are concerned. So this is why we have declined so much economically and socially in rural America is because the monopoly has stolen our share of the consumer food dollar. And in particular, what we want to talk about is the beef dollar. And so USDA publishes the USDA meat price spreads every month. And so I look at those and they're pretty good. I mean, they're showing around 34, 5% going back to the producer now. And that, and remember, in 1970, that was 65%. So right. Let's mandate. And I hate this. I hate that we have to regulate to this level, but you're dealing with a monopoly. You're not dealing with a competitive market that can respond.
That's right. That's right.
And so let's force them to make sure, based upon what the consumer is paying, and I would argue today the consumer is paying too much. So that can get adjusted, and that can happen through more of a competitive marketplace. What is the consumer paying for beef? And we are going to mandate that 65% of that get back to the farm and ranch gate or whoever finished those cattle. So it might be a Nebraska ranch sends their calves to a feedlot. The feedlot feeds them. So it's 65% of that finished animal. And then we're going to have to depend upon the feedlots and the people who grow those animals to finish weight than to compete for the calf. And that's a lot easier to do than to make four meat packers compete for finished cattle.
Right.
And so that has to happen. They get 65% of the consumer dollar. But all the while, what we're doing here is we're building that alternative pathway to the consumer in parallel and alongside of the existing mess that we've got with big meat packers and big distributors and big retailers and all of that. In other words, it's going to be more of the direct sale, local regional food system development that would allow smaller meat packers to start in business or the existing ones to have a way better chance of being successful.
Well, being
and selling
able to
more
compete
directly to consumers.
Absolutely. I mean, they cannot compete now. Not possible.
It's a
not
fool's
possible.
Game to get in the meat business right now.
Right.
It's a total
it
fool's
really
game.
Is. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute because you addressed that in the letter that you wrote to President Biden. But I want to keep going on this particular prescription of yours because you made several points about investment in smaller local plants, which we just talked about, but education in animal agriculture and also meat cutting, which has gone away. I mean, I worked as a butcher myself for 5 years in New York City, so I actually kind of know what we're talking about here. And, you know, it's not what they're doing down in those processing plants. I mean, they're, you know, cutting everything into their steaks and chops, but you don't have that opportunity. Like when I first started working in the industry in 1984, maybe, boxed beef had just started coming in. But we were getting really big primal cuts even so because we had skilled meat cutters and there nothing went to waste. Everything.
Right.
I was working with French guys too. So, I mean, yeah, you know, they're cutting the meat so that everybody is going to take home a tasty cut, no matter what you want to call it. Anyway, but my point is that you know, you're making a point that education is also a part of this prescription. And I wanted you to expand a little bit on that.
And what I asked, what I suggested last week on a call with USDA folks was, let's have USDA partner with the Department of Labor. They both have pools of money that are dedicated towards training programs so we can build better skill levels in people and with that, better incomes. Let's move a lot more people back to the middle class and let's get labor's compensated. Let's get them compensated to where they can live a good life as well.
Well, right, you made $35-$40 bucks an hour as a butcher back in the day.
Well,
solid middle-class life.
Again, 1970. You know, I graduated from high school in 69, but I worked in the meat market and at Thrifty Food Market in Evergreen, Colorado. And there's something that happened on April 25th, 1970 that changed the world in the slaughter and meatpacking business.
All right.
And that is when IBP's president and top executives met with Mo Steinman, the mafia representative in New York. New York City.
Really?
1970. And if you read the article and click on the 1970 at the very end, I just added the link.
And
it will take you to the article that talks about how IBP made a deal with the mafia to get box beef in New York City. Well, nobody wanted it. I mean, the butchers certainly didn't want it. Mm-hmm. They liked cutting carcasses.
And that was the end of the meatpacking district in New York.
Yeah, and they
had
to bribe the big retailers.
Yep.
They bribed the big retailers, and they bribed the union officials to get this job done, to get the box beef in. Well, that's what saved IBP. The New York market owed IBP a bunch of money, wouldn't pay him.
Uh-huh.
And so Courier Holman went back there and made the deal with Mo Steinman and the mafia, and they used the 50 cents a hundredweight on box beef to bribe the grocery store executives and union officials to absolutely force box beef into the market.
Wow.
And of course, it's got all kinds of negatives. I mean, for a big one is food safety. If you can age a carcass 6 to 7 days, that is the best pathogen intervention there is.
All right.
You compare that to box beef that goes into the box within 24 to 36 hours
after slaughter,
you're packaging the pathogens. And this is where the Jack in the Box and all of those things came from. But nobody wanted to talk about what was really causing the problem. So I'm talking about going back to our rural communities, and the administration is talking a lot about local regional food system development.
So let's put
in small slaughter plants, kill those animals near where they're raised. At Calgary Cattle Company, they don't even get on a truck. They're raised there, they die there, and the carcasses get shipped into the urban center where it's cut up. So that's the model I want to see more of. And then I think what we do, Katie, is we look for a 7% goal that no meat packer can control more than 7% of the national market. And so now we're going to give them 2 years to scale down and to get smaller. And they can sell off plants. They don't need that many plants. They can have one plant. And so let's start getting this thing back to where it works for people. Think of the national security implications that we have when we can't feed ourselves, or the food we do produce is sold to us by a handful of multinational corporations that aren't even from here. I'm talking about JBS, Marfrig, and Smithfield. That's Brazil and China. So this is critical. This is national security stuff that we're talking about.
I would agree with you there.
Why are we talking 7%? That's kind of a weird number. Well, if you take four firm concentration, we've always talked about when it reaches 40%, you no longer have a competitive market. Now, this is old sociology and economist stuff. When a market becomes concentrated at the point of 40%, you've already lost the market. Now it's easier. It's much easier for them to cooperate than to compete. And so I'm saying let's limit four firm concentration to 28%. That's below the 40% danger threshold.
Right.
Well, let's just say if we went 8%, well, then you'd be at 32%. So that's getting awful close to 40. Let's just say 7%. And we can set that in stone. And that could be a guideline for the Federal Trade Commission and the Justice Department on any merger approvals that might happen in the future. But right now, we've got to go backwards to restore a competitive market, which we do not have, not even anything even that resembles it.
Right. And what about, like, you know, there's always, people occasionally see in mainstream media, but I see it a lot because I read the trades, but the whole sort of enforcing the Packers and Stockyards Act, which stalled out under Obama. I mean, is how much impetus does that have under Vilsack in his second round as Secretary of Agriculture?
Well, depending on when you hear Vilsack talk, he's got a great script. I mean, I love it. I catch myself cheering when I hear him, and then again, he kind of gets on a different script, and I get sad again. But the deal is that the antitrust laws have never really been enforced in the meatpacking industry since 1921. And so we've got private right of action, which we took in 1996 against IBP, which then became Tyson. And then the judges decided, oh, well, you have to prove harm to competition. You know, you got to prove that their bad act or their preference or whatever violation of the act, of the plain language of the act, you've got to now prove harm to competition, in other words, the entire national market.
To every single person who's raising a cow, you have to show that they have been personally impacted by this lack of enforcement. Of course, that is an impossible task. You can't do it.
And so the way I compare that is a woman's purse is stolen by some guy. He's running down the street. And so you're angry about that purse being stolen. And so you file a complaint at the police station, and the police station says, ma'am, I'm really sorry about your purse, but unless you can prove that every woman that has a purse in America was also harmed, you don't get to file your case. And that's where a cattleman sets. I mean, I've got a feedlot in 1998, it's December. The big four packers, after I'd filed the suit in 96, have now gotten together and said, okay, Calicrate is not going to be a cattle feeder anymore because we're not going to buy his cattle.
Yeah.
So they all get together and decide, okay, no more. We're not buying Calicrate's cattle. Well, I only had one buyer. It was National Beef, which is now Marfrig.
Right.
And finally, the buyer told me, he says, you know, after I've complained, I said, you know, Don, I'm watching your National Beef trucks fly up and down the highway just east of me here a mile.
Right.
And you're not buying my cattle that are 200 miles closer to your plant. What is going on? And of course, I had 14,000 head in a 12,000 head feedlot because I couldn't sell.
Oh, my gosh.
And so Don finally said, he said, okay, Mike, I'm sorry. You know, I'm drinking your coffee every week. I'm not buying your cattle. I've been told I can't.
Wow.
And so his head buyer said he couldn't buy my cattle. Would have been nice if they had told me that earlier.
Yeah,
anyway,
right.
I give the Secretary of Agriculture, Dan Glickman, a call, who I know, he's from Kansas. And I said, Dan, why don't you enforce the Packers and Stockyards Act? And he said, well, you know, Mike, in this modern day of globalization, we need big meat packers that can do business globally. So that is the Kool-Aid that they have been drinking since 1921, basically, and really been drinking it heavily since Earl Butz was Secretary of Agriculture under Nixon.
Yes.
And so Obama finally comes along and realizes, uh-oh, we've really made a mistake here. Let's have some hearings. Let's start enforcing these antitrust laws. Let's enforce the Packers and Stockyards Act. Vilsack was secretary. They did all those hearings around the country.
Yeah.
Massive numbers of people showed up, and then they did nothing. But this is important. Lena Khan wrote the article, Obama's Game of Chicken. In other words, why was he afraid to enforce the antitrust law, particularly the Packers and Stockyards Act?
Yes.
Well, look who runs Washington. The lobbyists, the big food lobbyists, Farm Bureau,
right.
National Cattlemen's Beef Association, you know, all of your big commodity organizations fought them. I mean, they turned loose, the troops on Washington.
Yes.
So, but where is Lena Khan now? She was with Barry Lynn and his group, the Competitive Markets Group. Where is she now?
I don't know.
The chair of the Federal Trade Commission. And who broke up the Packers in 1921? The Federal Trade Commission. This is an opportunity like we've never had in 100 years. I'm so thankful that Lena Khan is where she is.
That's fantastic.
And so some good things could happen. You know, idea that we settle cases with criminals has got to stop. But the bottom line is the Justice Department, the Packers and Stockyards, don't have lawyers and legal staff that can compare with private law firms that represent the big monopolists.
Oh, definitely
not. So my suggestion to USDA is partner with private law firms. I mean, just imagine if you could have David Domina from Omaha, Nebraska on a team of lawyers, leading a team of lawyers against the big meat packers attorneys. He'll make mincemeat out of them. He'll grind them up and spit them out. That's who you got to have on your side.
Yeah.
The problem is when David Domina took our case to the Alabama court, the judge decided that we had to prove harm to competition. And the judge decided that the Packer had an excuse called rule of reason. In other words, they have to do it to compete with the other monopolists in the market. And it's just like in 1970, when IBP bribed the New York meat trade to get boxed beef in, that went to court too.
Mm-hmm.
And they got felony counts. But the judge ruled that Currier-Holman didn't have any other option. In other words, the rule of reason was he had to cheat to stay in business and compete. And so, okay, Currier, you can pay $7,000 in fines and you're not going to have to go to jail.
Right,
and that is still true today. The government agencies are settling cases and allowing these predators, these criminals, to continue to pillage and plunder producers on one side and consumers on the other.
That's exactly right. Listen, we have to take a short break now for a sponsor drop. We'll be right back with Mike Calicrate. Please stay tuned.
The future of farming in America is uncertain. Our farmers are aging and selling off their land. But the pandemic has revealed the importance of local farms as the national and international supply chain continues to be disrupted.
I mean, it's not like most farmers have a company-sponsored retirement plan.
I'm Hannah Forden, HRN's program manager, and I want to tell you about a new show. Hosted by John Piotti, the president and CEO of American Farmland Trust, and produced in collaboration with Heritage Radio Network, this is No Farms, No Future. There is a new generation of small farmers. We're here to tell their stories, share knowledge, and dig deep into the future of American farming. From land stewardship,
we are losing 2,000 acres of farmland a day.
The price of land is often so high that it's really hard to get started.
To cracks in the supply chain.
By the time I go shopping every single day, there's no meat left to feed my family.
The future of farms is the future of food. Subscribe to No Farms, No Future, a new podcast from American Farmland Trust and Heritage Radio Network. Find us wherever you like to listen.
Okay, so Mike, let's talk more about the points you made in a letter you wrote addressed to the president that was you published in, I think, January on your blog. And you made this really incredible point: without fair market access and the following reforms, which I'll read, pouring resources into new and existing food processing and distribution infrastructure is a waste of time and money. What do you mean by that? That is a very bold statement. I know what you mean by that.
Yeah.
But, you know, like,
I'm ready. Yeah, we'll talk about that.
You know, like, putting, there is a lot of talk about putting money into new food processing and distribution, blah, 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 you know, more small packing plants and whatnot. But they cannot compete, as you said earlier. I want you to, like, deconstruct why that stuff is not going to work, even though it sounds great on paper and everybody is, like, rubbing their legs together like crickets thinking, hey, the glory train has finally moved in. But no, because there isn't fair market access. So talk a little bit more about what that, you know, what those points are and, you know, where it has to start. Like, where is our first reform? Is that the using antitrust laws, breaking up the monopolies that you described? You know, where do we begin? Because this is huge. It's a huge task.
Yep, we can cover it. I got it.
So what does fair market access actually mean?
Well, it means access to a market that is competitive and a market that you know where you're at. I mean, there's a good opportunity for you to recover your cost of production. If you're an efficient operator, if you do a good job of managing, you're going to be able to make money in a marketplace.
Because why you're not allowed to, right? I want you to explain why you're not having that experience now. As a producer, what happens? You take your cattle to the slaughter plant, as you were describing when you brought your suit against IBP, and or whatever it was, and they say, okay, we're going to pay you this, and they just pick that number out of the whatever orifice they choose to hide it in, and you're saying, but wait a minute, like 6 months ago I got this. Why am I not? So that's what I want you to describe, that, because that is really outrageous.
I met John Tyson at the NCBA convention in San Antonio, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association meeting. I think that was the last meeting I ever went to. It was in 2001. And I don't want to go into too much detail, but I caught him coming out of the men's room on the trade show floor. Okay. And I knew that John Tyson was there to announce that IBP was going to buy, or Tyson was going to buy IBP.
He's going to buy IBP.
Mm-hmm. And so I stopped him and I introduced myself and I said, I'm Mike Calicrate and I'm one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit against IBP. Mm-hmm. And he looks at me with sort of a shocked look and he says, what lawsuit? I mean, he was fixing to buy the company. I said, well, it's a lawsuit based on the Packers and Stockyards Act that could cost IBP more than their entire market capitalization if we win.
Uh-huh.
And he said, oh, I know all about the Packers and Stockyards Act. And I said, yes, I know you probably do. And you probably also know that you wouldn't be where you are today in the chicken business had that law been enforced.
Right.
And we got to, you know, button heads a little bit. But finally, he backed down a bit and he said, let me tell you something. If you're suing IBP, you're suing the wrong people. You need to be suing Walmart. They dictate price to us. and we have no choice but to pay you less.
Uh-huh.
He just admitted he had the market power to pay me less. And I said, and that is our case. You should not have the market power to pay us less. So the course of least resistance is to pay the rancher less, because the feedlot is just a middleman. They don't care what calves cost. They don't care what cattle are bringing as finished to the packer. They only care about making that margin. And so they honestly don't have a whole lot to gain or lose. But the course of least resistance then becomes buying the calf cheaper. And this is how you lose 30-some% of your share of the consumer dollar. It's because of the market power of the biggest retailers, the biggest food service companies, dictating to the biggest meat packers. And then it works on down for lower prices to the producer. And so in order to fix this, you've got to break up that monopoly abusive market power. And that is done with antitrust, and it's most certainly not done with settling these price-fixing lawsuits.
I know, it's
these
amazing.
These guys have to pay big time. There needs to be people in jail. They've got us chained. We need injunctive relief. And so what I told John Tyson was right. I mean, we ended up winning the case in Montgomery, Alabama against Tyson. Irregardless of what the judge did on his jury instructions, the jury saw through it all and voted unanimously on every single point for the cattle producers. Mm-hmm. And we won the case and got $1.28 billion judgment. And then some of the jury, members of the jury, came to us and said, wow, you guys needed a lot more money, but we didn't have the mathematical calculation to give you more.
Wow.
But then what happened was the judge reversed the jury verdict, took it away from us. So we lost the $1.28 billion, and he charged us for Tyson's court costs of nearly $80,000.
Wow.
And then it went on to the appeals court, where they held up the rule of reason, and they held up the harm to competition, and they agreed with the judge reversing the case. Then we took it all the way to the Supreme Court, to Justice Roberts, who had just represented USDA in the Chekhov case in front of the Supreme Court. So you know whose side he was on.
Well, he has always been on the side of big money. I mean, Sheldon Whitehouse, who is my Rhode Island senator, has been doing a series for months now, since Biden was inaugurated, on dark money in politics and the Roberts Court. And he's very specific in calling out all of these pro-corporate decisions that Roberts has been ladling out, really, in his entire career on the bench, and one of the reasons why he was made Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. But I want to move on for a second here, Mike, because
the Supreme Court refused to hear the case in favor of hearing the Anna Nicole Smith family feud case. And here we are, the most important case in the cattle business and I think agriculture in 100 years, was thrown to the side. But what it did is it gave the green light to the monopoly to continue to extract wealth. And have they ever.
That is so true. And thank you for wrapping that up, because, you know, my brain is so, fluffy. I just, had my piece to say, and then I want to. I apologize when I jabber on the way I do. But there's another thing that you brought up in your letter to the president in January, and that was truth in labeling, stop food fraud, ban false, misleading, and deceptive labeling. What are the implications of labeling to the consumer and to producers? I want people to understand what that's about, because we're talking about cool here, right? Country of origin labeling,
talking about
right?
Something like cool. I mean, it's this is something we don't need Congress to help us with. This is something USDA could do tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Is stop imported meat from being able to carry the product of the USA label,
right?
And so they bring stuff in from JBS, the Batista brothers.
Yep.
They get to repackage it. It gets the product of the USA label. Well, it's like the hothouse tomatoes out of Canada coming into Colorado during the winter.
Right.
And they get the Colorado Proud label. So the kind of deceptive labeling we're talking about. That has to get fixed. And that's an easy one. USDA could do that by, later today if they wanted to, but they haven't. And they really should. But overall, labeling has become extremely deceptive and misleading, and downright to be fraudulent, which I would categorize the product of USA labeling as fraudulent, which would be the worst. But I got to tell you about a phone call I had from Roy Moore. It's been a couple of years ago, and he's 85 years old. He's retired on the ranch in Wyoming. Their family used to own Maverick Meat Company in Denver, and they were one of those sort of branded products that, you know, they were killing cattle and cutting it up and selling meat. And along at that same time, there was Coleman.
Yeah, I was going to say, it reminds me of Coleman Meat. Yeah, right, exactly. Right.
And then there was Bill Nyman, who had his brand. Laura's Lean had her brand. And what Roy Moore wanted to tell me, he said, Mike, you're the only one that's left out of all those brands. And this is part of the labeling problem. So these brands that were good brands that you know were out there in the market providing consumers with choice are now owned by someone else, a multinational corporation. Maybe it's General Mills like that bought Epic, or maybe it's Purdue that bought Nyman and bought Coleman, or Ari Meyer that bought Laura's Lean. And I call these zombie brands. These are brands that the consumer sees thinking it's a separate company and that there's a set of protocols that are more favorable to what the consumer wants. None of that is true. And we need the Federal Trade Commission to step in and stop this deceptive and misleading labeling, downright fraudulent labeling. And that's an easy one. We need to do that. And so that's one of the key points. And of course, the next one that I had on that list to President Biden was, we've got to stop subsidizing industrial agriculture.
Yeah.
The subsidizing that we do for corn and soy and a bunch of these things really benefits the big corporations that want cheap feed for their hogs and their cattle and their chickens and poultry operations.
Right.
We need to stop subsidizing that. And really what it's doing is it's causing loss of farmland, loss of topsoil.
Oh yeah.
Pollution of rivers and streams. Like look at Iowa. It's the best example of the worst.
Oh
practices.
My God. Totally ruined. Yeah. The state is like toxic.
You know, why aren't we growing dryland barley instead of sucking the old Galala aquifer dry, growing corn to export into Mexico below cost of production?
Yeah.
We are squandering precious fossil water to grow stuff we don't even need.
Yeah.
And so let's go back to some dry land. Let's start pulling water no more than what the recharge rate is, which means you get to shut down a whole bunch of center pivots in western Kansas. Mm-hmm. We've got to protect that water resource because it's actually the people's. It's not a handful of corporations' property.
Right, but they are sure as hell making the money off of it. Yeah, no, the water problems that we are facing in the coming decades are really terrifying. And completely, just under the radar. Nobody is paying attention to this stuff. We sell off agricultural land to foreign investors. We don't know who the hell they are. You know, they go through this weird little secretive organization in the government that's supposed to be vetting this stuff. But I mean, CIUSA or something like that, that it's the organization that, for example, gave the green light to the Smithfield purchase. You know, insane,
right.
Insane. Who's in charge? I mean, that was crazy. I was under the Obama administration. But I want to go
the revolving door. You know, those who regulate are now doing the regulating.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And another thing that you brought up was investing in and developing local marketplaces. And you had a very sweet photograph of, I didn't know where that marketplace was, but it reminded me of something you would see in almost any European city, and that is a big. Where was it?
That was the Queen Victoria Market in Melbourne, Australia.
There you go.
And so I was there, and I took that picture. But what was really cool about that market in the meat area, the meat hall, they called it, massive, huge, the biggest public market I've ever seen in my life. But in the meat hall, there were carcass rails running down both sides of the aisles.
Sure.
And so years ago, when they were in the carcass trade, those rails were transporting meat to the meat shops all along. There was a bunch of different meat shops in the meat hall.
Yeah.
And so they'd bring in the carcasses early in the morning when it was cool. And they'd roll those things down to the meat shops where then they'd put the carcass in their cooler. Just like the market I worked in Evergreen, Colorado in the late 60s.
Right.
Where we cut carcasses instead of boxes. Well, you know what happened. Australia, now Conagra, now JBS. Conagra became JBS. they've taken over the Australian market along with Cargill, and it's all
to a great degree. Yes.
So what I want to be able to do is bring back the carcass trade, which is going to be far more efficient, far better, safer, higher quality, and open up these small meat markets that are owner operated with good, highly skilled cutters making good livings. Yeah. And I want to cut it from the carcass all the way to the consumer and sell it in a fresh counter and just bring it all back. I remember in Evergreen, Colorado, working in that meat market on a Saturday morning, you could never, ever be sick or call in and not show up because you had to get there early. And we stacked that meat counter. We stacked it high from end to end. And I just remember the consumers, the customers would come in and they'd be eight deep and eight wide and we would roll.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, that doesn't happen anymore.
No, it doesn't. It really doesn't. I saw that.
Bring it back.
Yeah, I would agree. I've seen that in many other countries.
What we got to do in addition is it can't just be the meat market. I want to go into this place and I want to see the carcasses hanging, everything transparent behind glass. I want to see the cutters cutting. I want to be able to buy fresh cuts, but I also want to buy my bread from the baker that's in the same place.
Right.
His whole baking operation is there. I want to be able to buy my cheese from the cheesemaker and from the creamery. I want to be able to buy my coffee from the coffee roaster and the folks in the brewery. I want to be able to have a beer. and a hamburger and a carnita tacos. And I just want it to be the public market that every urban center deserves to have. But you're going to get major, major pushback from the developer community. They hate those kind of public gathering places because the rents are cheap. They have to be and should be because you're providing a public service, but you're providing all the processing beyond slaughter. So let the small communities slaughter the animals close to where they are. We'll ship the carcasses into these wonderful community marketplaces and distribute our meat directly to consumers, putting a lot more money back to the farm and ranch gate than even the 65% that I suggested earlier.
Right, And as you also made the point, it's a safer chain of production.
Right,
because
exactly.
you're avoiding a lot of the potential for pathogens to infiltrate and colonize.
The other reason that developers and rent collectors hate these public markets because the rents are affordable.
Yeah,
and they are public gathering places where people talk with one another, not like a Walmart, not like a big box store where you walk across the aisle to avoid someone. This is where people come and gather and communities have an opportunity to become better places to live because these are citizens in addition to consumers. And so we vote for a city council that represents community as opposed to Wall Street interests with chains and franchises.
Right.
We get a better mayor that represents the interests of the public. And that they fear that that's a huge fear for the developer rent collecting economy and people who make their money off of it. And so what we're doing in Colorado Springs is we're going to build that place that I just described, but it's going to be owned by the occupants. And so the brewer, the distiller, the coffee roaster, the creamery, the meat market, the baker, we're all going to share in the ownership of this beautiful facility. It's going to have some really cool architecture, more in line with airflow, sunlight, just a great place to be. It's going to have community space for meetings. It's going to have a huge commercial kitchen and incubation space. We'll have the food trucks showing up. It's just going to be where it happens. But we're going to do it on a private basis because you can't trust the city to support it. I mean, I worked for 10 years in Colorado Springs to build that public market concept, and it was flatly rejected by city leadership. So we're just going to build it anyway. And it's going to be privately owned. But I would welcome any city in the country to support that. There is a project in Grand Junction right now, more on the community basis of consumers owning it and providing the opportunities for small business to come in. Because one of the big risks that small businesses face is the risk of increased rents. And everybody's heard about the New York restaurant that made the place only to have their rent doubled. and yeah. put out of business.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the one thing, I mean, I don't mean to throw cold water on the idea because I love this and I've spent a lot of time in Europe. I've been to many of those markets. But even some of the most traditional cities like Madrid, which used to have like six or seven of these big markets, they are starting to founder. I mean, the population, even in European countries, is loving the convenience of the supermarket. And these are cultures that still cook, still have three squares a day, don't eat processed foods, but they're loving the convenience of the supermarket. And that really is tragic. I really hope your vision prevails, Mike, because it is certainly a much better way to shop and eat and stay connected to the people in your community and the people who are making your food. But it's a tough road to hoe.
Let's think about this a second. All of the businesses that I described that are going to be in this place mm-hmm. are currently successful and established businesses on their own by themselves. Yeah. What is the synergy in bringing these businesses together under one roof? We all pick up each other's customers.
Yes, this for
thing,
sure.
This thing doesn't, I mean, I know the shift towards convenience and big box, but yeah. I think after COVID, people might have a better attitude.
Well, you might be right about that. I think you might have a very good point there.
But the other thing is that when we come together as businesses within this space, we are sharing that freezer. We are sharing the big cooler. We're mm-hmm. sharing the dry goods storage area.
That's right.
We're sharing a lot of expense that each one of us would have individually. And so now we've got a more affordable place to be. And we're also serving much of the interest of the community. So I'm excited about it. I think it sounds great.
Running the numbers,
the rent, or it's not the mortgage payment, is going to be cheaper than the rent would have been with a developer.
Right. Yeah, I believe that. You know, we only have a couple minutes left. And I want to go back to one last point about politics here. And that is that most people in your community, most farmers and ranchers, tend to be conservative, vote a Republican ticket. And, you know, in a large sense, they have very much participated in the demise of their whole shtick by supporting Republican policies that have fostered large corporate interests. So where is the impetus in rural America to start voting for a different type of politician? Like, how do you get that? You know, is it through establishing a market like you're talking about? Like, where do you get the support for ideas like yours in a community that is typically and traditionally very Republican? And I don't mean that idea, Trump people. I just mean very conservative politically, right?
Yeah, the idea that I described is going to be in the urban center, so we still aren't going to be reaching the folks, other than hopefully paying them a better price for their production.
Right.
But what I've seen in rural America, where I live in St. Francis, Kansas, is it's traditionally Republican. It's traditionally conservative. And I don't know what's conservative about four meatpackers controlling the market. I don't know what's conservative about, Monsanto charging, you know, exorbitant prices for seed corn. And right. I don't know what's conservative about allowing fertilizer prices to skyrocket the way they have. But the problem I think we've got in rural America is we've become very tribal. I mean, you couldn't hardly go into a business, you know, 10 years ago that Rush Limbaugh wasn't on the radio.
That's right.
Blasting through the place. And so they've become very tribal and they sided with the Republicans. I tell you what, both parties have sold us out. You gotta know that the anger and the support for Trump was because everybody was very mad and very angry about both parties. Uh-huh, and both sure. parties have done a great job of working for Wall Street. I mean, why do they have to yep. shove the Dow in our face every time we turn a TV on or radio? Get them out of here. Shove Wall Street into the ocean. We need to get back to Main Street and stop investing contrary to our own self-interest. But I just remember when I first got into the IBP lawsuit and I was getting to know the lawyers. And here we've got this set of Alabama attorneys. David Dominick came along a little bit later after class certification. But early on, I was talking to the Alabama lawyers And of course, this was the greatest venue because it's down south where they do big jury awards. And these lawyers had, had taken some big pharmaceutical and hospital folks to task and done well in some class actions. And I said, why are you guys all Democrats? And and Randy said to me, he says, Mike, have you ever run into a Republican that cared about the little guy? And I thought, and I'm not now, I'm a Republican at the time.
Right.
And I'm thinking, gosh, damn, Randy, I'm going to think of somebody. Hang on just a minute. I'll think of somebody. And you know what? I couldn't think of anybody. And they Republicans have always supported big business.
Yes.
And the Democrats do, too. They just say they don't.
They just say they don't.
They did. And so I just think we've got to quit. We've got to throw out the labels. We've got to stop talking about conservative and liberal and all that baloney. And I think we've got to get back to community, working with each other to make it as good as we can make it, and not worry about so much about Dan Glickman's globalization, but sort of build our communities to where they're great places to live and people are compensated well for the wealth they create and the work that they do,
right.
Support each other. And that model of a public market that I described, I think, goes a long ways towards that. One of the things we do at Range Foods Direct is, there's a guy that makes soap. There's a lady that makes soap a different kind. I mean, they're using beef tallow and rendered pork fat in their soaps. We've got a SoCo market that we host on Saturdays out of our food hub in Colorado Springs that sells 100 and some different vendors' products. And it's curbside. You don't have to even get out of your car. I mean, we've got the Ahava Farm CSA pickup on Fridays. You just start building that community. Ranch Foods Direct probably sells 100 products that Cattle Creek Cattle Company doesn't have a thing to do with.
Amazing.
All we've done is provided them the space to be able to do business.
So
you start building these small businesses back again, but we just need a little help from government to enforce those antitrust laws, keep the predators at bay while we build this new infrastructure.
I love that. We're going to have to close it there, Mike, but thank you. That is a ringing call to action, people. Listen to Uncle Mikey. He knows what he's talking about. Mike, it's always a great pleasure to chat with you. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, and we'll stay in touch. I'll keep reading that blog. Where can people read your blog, by the way? Remind people of where they can read.
It's at MikeCalicrate.com, and it's the lower left button is the blog.
All right. Sounds great. All right. Thank you, my friend. We'll speak again soon. You betcha.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.